flavour.
This is Cambridge Radio.
I'm going to read you the menu. It's fantastic.
So we get better flavour because of the fen soil.
I've drunk more beer since I came here and bought my two barrels than I've ever done in my life before, I think.
I shouldn't have said almonds. They don't make it from almonds.
So you've got this big sticky mess when you start off.
Pizza pot pies.
My wife's cakes are selling up hot cakes. Brilliant, thank you.
The time is right for this sort of thing.
Food is everything.
Cambridge is right for this sort of thing.
What's it like?
Good afternoon and welcome to Flavour here on Cambridge Radio. I'm Matt Bentman and Alan Alder is back from his holidays. He's sitting opposite me in our Guido Street studios and we're both ready to devote the next hour to local food and drink. So, hope you had a good holiday, Alan.
Yes, I did, thank you, Matt. But it's always nice to be back. And since I've been back, I've enjoyed some really good, fresh Cambridge asparagus.
Which is a good thing because we have a feature on asparagus today too.
Yeah, we've got some local chefs giving ideas for how to use it. And another feature we've got today is my visit to a farm in Willingham this week, which I found really inspiring. It's a farm which had been abandoned for several years, so nature had run rampant. The barns and some very big greenhouses had fallen into disrepair and as a result have become havens for wildlife. And gradually the couple who have taken it over are sorting things out while protecting the wildlife, and they've established a market garden mat on which they're growing not only salad, crops and fruit and vegetables, but tea.
Tea, perfect.
I've never seen tea growing, and some South American root vegetables which I'd never heard of before.
Beautiful. Well, we've also got some news about a new cafe opening in Cambridge. Its official opening is today, in fact, and our colleague Sue Bailey will be talking about flavour combinations.
And we'll have our regular features, free food in Cambridge, local food and drink news, social media updates and job vacancies.
But first, and unusually, we start with some bad news. Harvey's Coffee House off West Road is closing on the 26th of June, and there has been a lot of people on Instagram saying how sad that is. Alan, you went and had a chat with Michael, the owner, didn't you?
Yeah, I spoke to him on Wednesday morning and, you know, he was saying how increased costs were a real problem.
Like the price of coffee?
Well, that's gone up a lot in the last few months. And also, you know, there's been increases in national insurance contributions that employers make. That went up in April. And energy costs, as we all know, have gone up a lot. But it's a great shame because Harvey's is a lovely place in a lovely setting. And you can sit outside by the lawns away from the noise of the city. The coffee and cakes are very good. Some of them are supplied by local producers, which we've had on this programme. And the people who work there are really welcoming. There's just a lovely atmosphere. I think one of the issues is that because they're located on the university's Sidgwick site, just off West Road, the majority of their customers are from the university, though they are open to all. And that means that while they're very busy during term time, they're less busy out of term time, which, of course, is more than half the year.
Yeah. Has Michael got any plans for the future?
I think not at the moment, other than working every day up to June the 26th to save on staff costs. And he's retaining the name Harvey's for when or if he can get other premises.
OK, and here's Michael talking about costs at the recent Darwin Coffee Society panel.
You've got to be creative, especially if you're young, you don't have the funds. I would really be wary of getting loans because it's a very, very unprofitable lifestyle. Especially if you're just doing coffee, I would say it's a lifestyle more than it is to make money. Like, you're doing it because you want to be there, you build a community, and it's life. So you don't want to then have to owe money. I would really avoid that if I were you, especially to people who can take your house or whatever. Mm-hmm. But if it's mum and dad, obviously, then ask away. So look for opportunities. I personally am not the biggest fan of trucks, but I actually think they are a good option. It's just I personally don't want to do it. Or find quirky spaces. Like, Cambridge is full of colleges who have an issue with community building in this city. Like, it is a big mm-hmm. issue. And I think the only reason that Keys went with me is because they had a mental health crisis in college post-COVID, and they were like, we need to do something with this common room, which was a fox walked through the room whilst we had our meeting. Like, it was a dead space. It was bleak. And I was like, I don't know if I want to do this, actually. Like,
so what got you to do it in the end?
Well, yeah, they paid for it, basically. And then I just needed to get the equipment. And it comes with a real headache of, you know, half the decisions you can't make. You know, your flexibility afterwards is less, but you can attest to concepts, you know, and you can grow from there. So be creative with where you can find spaces if you don't have the funds. It's hard. Most roasteries might want to do a deal with you and then you commit to their beans. That's fine. But then maybe you can rent the machines and all of a sudden then you can test a concept for 3 months, 6 months without throwing tens of thousands at equipment. Like, I've worked in coffee for a lot of time. I knew exactly what I wanted, but finding secondhand stuff for that stuff is a bit risky because machines just start breaking left, right and centre. Like, do go for new or go with rented from a roastery, which will show up the next day and repair it for you. That kind of reassurance, because you can't afford days of being without a machine where you're paying staff, where you're missing out on overheads and yeah.
Yeah, well, there's Michael from Harvey's, and we hope Michael starts somewhere else up because, as I said, Harvey's has got a really special atmosphere, and I think he's part of the reason why.
Yeah, yeah.
And now details of free food available in and around Cambridge. And the information about what's available and where to get it comes from the Olio app. And that exists so that people's or businesses' surplus food doesn't go to waste.
And today's look at Olio for Cambridge shows us that Laurel, who is off Milton Road, has been busy picking from her garden. She's got stacks of fresh oregano, rosemary and thyme to give away. Next up is Kelly near Wolfstan Way, who has a box of peppermint-infused tea bags. It was her first time buying them, and she says they're just not for her, taste-wise. Whilst the minimalistically named C near Fenton Road, close to Addenbrookes, has a 500-gram packet of icing to give away. Now, one thing I've not mentioned here before is that sometimes people will pre-list items. So, for example, Anya, who is near the Green Dragon by the river, will be doing a collection for free Tesco items this evening. That's Saturday, if you're listening to our live show. It's Saturday at 9 p.m. So you just simply keep an eye on the app, wait till 9, and she'll post up all of the things, the goods that she's collected, and then you make your requests of what she's posted. So that usually means a long list. That's our Olio look for today.
Right, those fresh herbs from the garden sound rather good, don't they?
They really do, yeah. Mm-hmm. The rosemary and the oregano. Fresh oregano is beautiful,
yeah,
isn't it?
Fantastic. Mm. And there's another app called Too Good To Go, and that has unsold foods from restaurants, cafes and shops, and often at less than half price. Instead of specifying each unsold item, the surplus food is put into a magic bag, and that's ready for you to take home. And again, that saves it being binned at the end of the day's trading. And some of the companies that have used it recently in Cambridge include the Clayton Hotel, Ibis Hotel, the YHA, Pizza Express, Cafe Nero, Gales, Norfolk Street Bakery, Barrington Village Stores, Budgins and Arbury, and really rather a lot of others.
What a lot too. OK, let's go on to our first news break now for the 3rd of May, and Sweet Pea Market Garden Stall can now be found every Friday outside Cambridge Station from 12 till 2 p.m, and they will have a big variety of ultra-fresh salad crops and herbs on sale.
Some markets coming up this month are Caxton Farmers Market on the 11th of May, Histon's Farmers Market on the 17th of May, Ely Farmers Market on the 10th and 24th of May, and the Grandstands Market on the 25th of May. Now, the next Cheveley Farmers Market is on the 22nd of June, and there are some places available for traders, but you'll need to contact them now.
Cambridge Juice Company, which we featured on our last programme, has announced that their apple and raspberry drink, made from apples and raspberries grown locally, is now available in cans.
Yeah, and can I just say that how nice that drink is? It is really, really special. Gourmandise has a class coming up in Cottenham on the 16th of May, cooking the curries of the island of Reunion. When we checked, which was on Wednesday, there were only three places left, but it is happening again on the 20th of June and the 4th of July. On all the dates, the times are from 10 till 3, and the cost is £130. Corinne has lots of other classes available too, and they're all on her website.
My Foodie Days has an Italian supper club on the 15th of May at 7 p.m. in The Lab in Regent Street. It's a four-course meal which includes finger foods such as a goat cheese and asparagus basket topped with edible flowers. The main is pesto lasagna with asparagus, garden peas and courgette, and the dessert is roasted strawberry with whipped ricotta, crumble and meringue shards. And the cost for that is £55.
Gwydir Street Supper Club's next event is the 24th of May, and all dishes, except perhaps the pudding, will come from the barbecue. It will cost £50 for the vegetarian menu, £55 for pescatarians and £60 for carnivores. There will also be baba ganoush, a range of salads and lots of smoky flavours.
Starting tomorrow, the 4th of May, and every Sunday after that, Pudini Caterers are serving a Sunday roast at North Stow Tap and Social. That's between 12 and 4pm. Now, this is a reservation only, so send a message or email North Stow Tap and Social to make your booking.
Every Friday, the Astronomer in Eddington is offering two steaks, two sides and two glasses of house wine for £65. And you can choose from ribeye steak, sirloin, flat iron or anglais. And there's a choice of sauces and side dishes. And that's the news for now. More later.
So, despite the difficulties facing food and drink businesses at the moment, new ones are still opening. Flux opens today, Saturday, in Newnham, though there was a soft opening yesterday. Earlier in the week, Alan went along to talk to the owner, Marcy.
Marcy, you're opening a new cafe in Newnham. What's it called?
It's called Flux Coffee.
And it's in...
Osterley Avenue.
OK, the place that Meadows used to occupy.
Exactly the same space, yeah.
Right, and what's it going to be like?
It'll be serving specialty coffee, really lovely hot chocolate and teas. I've got quite a big selection, actually. I probably shouldn't have got so many. I'm only having about 8 seats in there, so it's not a lot of space, but I'm hoping it'll be quite enough that I can talk with all of the people that come in to see me and get coffee. I'm hoping it'll be a lovely space for people in the community to meet each other and come in to for the coffee and myself and to have conversation.
Actually, I mean, that does slightly remind me of Dom's place.
Oh, you know Dom's?
Yes, because a lot of conversation goes on with him and his customers as well.
Yes, I'm a regular at Dom's as well, so it wouldn't be quite like Dom's, although it sounds like it, because Dom's is very special and it is what it is because of Dom as well. But I think it has some elements that are similar with the bar that I have, but also I will have some seating slightly towards the front of the shop. So I'll have some seating away from the bar as well, near the front of the shop, and also outside. I'm hoping to get a bench so people can sit there and enjoy it as well.
And food, will you be... well, actually, before we get on to food, you've got a lot of experience in making coffee, haven't you? You've worked in quite a few different Cambridge coffee shops.
I have. I started in 2015 at Hot Numbers, and since then I've sort of moved around a few of them in Cambridge, one being the Locker Cafe.
Did you work at Bold Brothers?
I did, yes.
Yeah.
I'm
Are you going to be offering food? I mean, talking about Dom again, Dom famously doesn't offer food, so...
No, that's true. He does very particular sort of coffee, and especially he specialises in the pour-over coffee. And I think for me, I do more milk-based coffee and espresso-based. So starting with espresso and then adding milk to it. The latte art is something I quite enjoy as well. And I think combined in my cups and the latte art is quite a beautiful scene. And I think people would appreciate it.
Yes, well, I've seen the cups which you make yourself, and they really are really quite special. Okay,
thank
but
you
what
so
about
much.
Food, though? You're going to be offering food?
At first, I'm going to start with what I know, which is coffee primarily, and then I would really love to expand from there, but because it's going to be just myself in the space, I don't want to do it too quickly and too much and overwhelm myself, so... I've got people that are interested in making me things, which is so lovely, and I'll look at those options, and once I'm open, I'll get a very good feel of what might be right for the space.
Yeah, and people might be saying
you're telling
what
me
they
exactly
would like,
they
your,
would like,
your customers as well. That's brilliant. So when are you opening?
I'm hopefully going to be open this weekend, even before this is out, maybe.
Oh, right, you think you're opening on the Saturday?
Yes. Yeah, so,
right, that's soon, OK.
Yes.
And what sort of... And are you going to be open every day, or are there going to be days when you close?
I'm going to take 2 days off. It will be Tuesdays and Wednesdays I'll be closed, but otherwise I will be open. And the weekdays, it will be 8 till 3, and weekends will be 9 till 4. I'm going to try all these hours out, but I think they should work.
Yeah. Brilliant. Well, that's really exciting that there's a new cafe coming along.
Thank you so much.
And good luck.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Yeah, best wishes to Marcy at Flux in Eltersley Avenue, opening officially today.
More news now, and on the 7th of May at Parker's Tavern, Chef Lee Clark has special nose-to-tail lamb menus with locally sourced accompaniments. That's at 7pm, and the cost is £39.50.
Addington Beer Garden is on from the 9th to the 11th of May with breweries like Brewboard and Papworth Brewery, along with low and no alcohol options. Food will be provided by Pig Casso's, Rapunzel, Hit Rap, Manor Soul and Taste of Cambridge. It's free to attend, but you are asked to register in advance, which you can do via Eddington's Instagram account.
Cam's Cuisine has a summer of beer festivals, beginning at the Tickle Arms from the 23rd to the 25th of May.
Looking a little further ahead, on the 4th of June, Finboys in Mill Road has a selection of rosé wines paired with specially designed dishes such as devilled eggs and oyster mayo and Portland crab. The evening is hosted by Hal Wilson of Cambridge Wine Merchants.
On the 20th of June, there is a sundowner at Amelie with flamkouche, wine and cocktails, garden games and live music too. So just take a picnic blanket.
On the 13th of September, it's the Ely Coffee Fest where you can try cupping, latte art and roasting your own beans. There's also an espresso theory and practical workshop. Tickets can be bought from the Silver Oak Coffee website.
Meanwhile, over in Congratulations Corner today are Francesco and everyone at Aromi, which turned 12 years old this week. And we were just talking about how we remember the opening. We were there, weren't we?
We went along and we had a tasting, didn't we, of their foods. It was fantastic. It was really, really good. And it's done very well. I mean, Aromi is a big success.
It really is, yes. And Provenance is 10 years old in May. Celebrations include a silent disco from 6.30 to 11pm on the 15th of May, and it will be accompanied by a wood-fired menu along with cocktails, beers and soft drinks. Tickets are available now at £5, and that includes a welcome drink. And congratulations too to Amelie for winning the Best Regional Restaurant Award from Muddy Stilettos and also being named as a local gem by the Good Food Guide. That's all for now. More news later.
Amelie is a big success as well.
Yeah, and their food is, well, very, very lovely.
Yeah, absolutely. On now to some ideas from local chefs for asparagus, which is so good at the moment. I had some from Claire at the Brownsfield Farm Stall on Cambridge's Sunday Market, and it really was delicious. First, though, some background information from occasional flavour contributor Liz Budd.
Asparagus, according to Jane Grigson in her vegetable book, needs to be eaten the day it's cut. She says it should be served warm or cold, rather than hot, from the pan, as it's eaten with the fingers. One sometimes sees white asparagus for sale, which is produced by earthing up the asparagus shoots so no light gets to them. Nikki Segnett's not impressed by this form. She describes it in the Flavour Thesaurus as a slimy, anemic tube, free of the rich nuttiness that makes proper green asparagus such a treat. She continues, for some reason the Spanish, who have so much to commend them gastronomically, put it in salads where it lies hidden in the leaves like a chef's long-forgotten finger.
Now we move on to Rosie Sykes, followed by Tristan Welch.
Asparagus, I absolutely, is one of my favourites, and I try and eat it as many days of the week that I can while it's in season, because I don't believe in eating asparagus from anywhere else in the world. In fact, I have a friend over from America who is British, and they said that whenever they're back in asparagus season, they have to have it as much as possible. So my favourite thing to eat with asparagus is a Spanish sauce based on the Spanish soup ajo blanco, which is an almond dressing, basically. So ajo blanco is often an almond soup, chilled almond soup served with grapes. Really delicious, but quite hard to have a whole bowl of. But if you make it a bit thicker as a kind of coating sauce with asparagus, it is off the hook. So basically toast some almonds, throw them in the food processor with a bit of hot water, just to bring them to a paste, add some sherry vinegar, a clove of garlic and some olive oil, salt and pepper. Really simple. I love throwing asparagus in the oven. Just when it's fresh and young, it takes very little time. Bit of salt and pepper, tiny bit of olive oil into a hot oven and just kind of roast it, and it really comes out beautifully. But again, with anchovy butter and a soft-boiled egg, you know, in a tart, there are so many possibilities with asparagus, I think.
Tristan, we're at the height of the asparagus season. Have you got any good ideas for asparagus?
I'm so excited about asparagus season. I love it. Do you know what I really adore about asparagus is the simplicity it requires to cook it. So just in a pan with a knob of butter or a tablespoon of oil, just barely cover them with water, so maybe about a centimetre deep of water, no more, on a very high heat, pinch of salt, and you let the water reduce down to absolutely nothing. The butter will coat the asparagus, or the oil will coat the asparagus, and you'll have perfectly seasoned, perfectly cooked asparagus in a one-pan wonder.
Nazima Pafan and her husband Pierre used to run the Franglais Kitchen Supper Club, which was very popular and highly regarded. Nazima, by the way, is now an author, having written two novels. But anyway, in 2015, she gave us some ideas for asparagus, and here's an extract.
So what's nice about this vegetable is that, aside from the traditional uses that we see in this country of pairing it with fish and seafood or with eggs with soldiers, for example, we can see it used across the world. So from Far East Asia in Vietnam and Korea, and Chinese cultures used it particularly as a side dish with sesame seeds. I've seen a very nice Korean recipe where they steam it along and then tie it with some steamed prawns into little bundles and use it and serve it with a dipping sauce. It's a nice little canapé, and the dipping sauces with the traditional gochujang paste, which is a sort of hot red pepper paste that is relatively easily available from ethnic stores. I've got some from the shop on Mill Road, and they, into that you add a little bit of lemon juice or vinegar and some garlic and salt and pepper, and it's just delicious. And it's a really nice idea to sort of add a little bit of spice to it. The kind of flavours that asparagus can go with, as I've mentioned, the sort of egg and seafood, but other things that it can take are things like truffle, obviously garlic and parmesan, as well as balsamic, and also almonds and nuts. So we've done a sort of vegan barbecue idea, which on our blog, which is essentially charring asparagus and sweet corn, and then getting the sweet corn off the cob and sort of serving it on top of the charred asparagus with some peanuts, roasted peanuts chopped up, and some chives. And again, that flavour combination works quite well together and offers something if you've got people who don't want to have meat on a barbecue. It's quite a nice filling and flavourful alternative.
And local chef Jamie Mountford has some more advanced suggestions here. This is also from the Flavour Archive. So when he talks about Steve at the Green Man in Grantchester, it's Steve Thompson, the foraging chef, that he's referring to. Steve left the Green Man quite some time ago.
Jimmy, you got some ideas for asparagus with Jack by the Hedge, I think.
Yes.
So
yes.
This, I've never come across this combination before.
So what it is I'm very close to the guys at Cambridge Asparagus, who are just based down near Linton, actually. It's a farm. You know, they give me a text every year when they start producing the asparagus. I go down with a couple of lads from the kitchen and we go and pick our own asparagus. It's fantastic to do first time of the asparagus season. And then, you know, I love asparagus. It's an amazing ingredient. And when it's in its bloom, I really do pump it on the menu, you know, put it on specials. And it's so flexible, you know. Classic dishes, asparagus, poached egg, balsamic vinegar, parmesan, you know, one of the first dishes I ever learned to cook. Don't ever cook your asparagus for longer than 3 minutes. 3 minutes are perfect. And if you go to Cambridge Asparagus, you know, you pick it straight out of the field and it tastes like fresh peas. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, plenty of salt on there. Sea salt I tend to use. And Jack by the Hedge is a foraged ingredient, which I was introduced to by Stephen down at the Green Man in Grantchester. And he was like, try this out. It's a bit of a mustard flavour. You know, it's fantastic with asparagus. So what I did was took this ingredient, and what I did is I created a panna cotta, a savoury panna cotta. And I used a seaweed base, which is agar-agar. What I did was brought some milk and cream up to the boil, chucked the Jack by the Hedge in as I blitzed it in the food processor, which keeps the green so it doesn't go too dark, so to speak. And then I added the agar-agar and set this in the This keeps it vegetarian as well. And also with the flowers from the jackpot hedge, you can garnish the dish with. So what I tend to do is get the asparagus, blanch it for 3 minutes, and straight into ice-cold water, and then put the panna cotta on the dish, chuck some wild mushrooms on there, plenty of shaved black truffle, and you touch of hollandaise. It's a fantastic dish, you know. And jackpot hedge is an ingredient that grows on the side of the road.
It's plentiful around Cambridge,
loads,
isn't it?
Loads. There's absolutely loads. Yeah. I tell you what, I do need to find it. I need to find a... Because I love my foraging, you know. I take my son out foraging. Get wild garlic. I'm really struggling to find wild garlic.
Right, well, when we've stopped recording, I'll tell you where I find it.
But when you're foraging, please do, you know, as a chef, my job is to respect Mother Nature. My job is to manipulate flavours for a dish for people to try. You know, Mother Nature creates everything, and when you're picking things, make sure you leave a little bit more than what you've taken, so it gets a chance to grow back and nature can take its course, really.
Yeah. Thanks to Jamie Mountford there. Very responsible words there about, you know, being mindful of nature. I quite like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so how do you cook your asparagus, Alan?
Well, last time I was here, which was two programmes ago, if you remember, Kirsten Horn from the Gwydir Street Supper Club was here. And he mentioned that he had this idea of doing a supper club with nothing but asparagus dishes on the menu, but he's since abandoned that idea on advice from friends. But anyway, I asked him how he'd like to cook asparagus, and he said, well, there are just so many ways, but one of the easiest and best ways, he said, was just to fry it in a light oil, like a sunflower oil, with some salt. And that's what I did, and it was lovely.
Oh, okay.
I think I probably fried it for slightly too long, but it was still just nice and crisp, and the flavour was there, and the green colour was still fantastic.
So you prefer that over boiled?
Yeah, I'm going off boiling vegetables. I just think it's something we rather overdo. But,
And lose the specialty, the value of them.
Yeah, through. I think so. Yeah. And you lose a lot of the nutrients, as I think Nazima
said. That's the word
said.
I was trying to say.
Right.
Radio, eh? OK, well, coming up on Flavour Today, the remarkable story of Briar Farm. We've also got wine news, jobs and a social media update. That's after the break in 2 minutes' time. Don't go away.
Cambridge Radio.
Celebrate the heartbeat of our community through the power of women's sports. Every fortnight, Women's Sports Mix takes you from the football pitches to the hockey fields, where skill meets determination. And it's not just about watching, it's about taking part. Find out how you can join your local teams, clubs and initiatives.
I don't think I've really known anyone who's tried rugby and hated it. I really do. I think everyone who I've either dragged along, most of them still play.
Women's Sports Mix, online whenever you want, and Tuesday at 6 on Cambridge Radio.
Step into the world of virtual reality at VR Extra, Cambridge's first virtual reality centre. Battle zombies, escape lost worlds, or challenge your friends in our action-packed VR games. VR Extra is perfect for families, parties, and corporate events, with customised packages available. And when you've survived the apocalypse, grab a coffee, smoothies, and fresh sandwiches in our cafe. Find us at 65 Regent Street, Cambridge, next to Parker's Peace. Book now at vrextra.com/Cambridge. VR Extra, where family fun meets virtual adventure.
Want a podcast for your daily cycle?
Download the Radio Player app and search Cambridge Radio.
Welcome back to Flavour and a trip to the wonderfully peaceful Briar Farm in Willingham, which I visited during the week. And the atmosphere there is wonderful. The air is filled with birdsong, as you will hear as we tread the path up to the market garden, and that itself is full of surprises. I'm at Briar Farm, really on the edge of Willingham, and it's amazingly rural. And I'm with Steve and Farinoz, and we're walking over to the... Where are we going?
We're heading over to the market garden.
And you've been going for around about 3 years. And you have a strong philosophy. Would you like to explain what you believe in?
So we're trying to create a mixed agroecological farm here. So we've got the market garden as part of a wider system, trying to work with nature in everything we do, and have a patchwork of habitats and environments for nature to thrive, and also growing food for our local community, and it being somewhere that's productive and resilient for the future.
So what sort of nature?
We're working with the RSPB because we've been lucky enough to spot turtle doves on site. So we've got a partnership with them, creating good habitat and also doing supplementary feeding to try and attract them to nest in the area. We're really lucky to have a big section of scrub habitat, which is brilliant for turtle doves and lots of other birds and wildlife. We're also partnered with the Wildlife Trust locally and the Hawk and Owl Trust to really just make sure that we're getting all those different diverse habitats that can give us the best chance of attracting all of the amazing wildlife around.
And you've got some old buildings here, which must attract wildlife. I mean, bats, owls, that sort of thing. Have you got...
Yeah, that's right. So we did have a bat survey done fairly early on and when we moved in, and they identified was 8 of the 12 species of bats in Cambridgeshire within a week of trapping.
And that was, we've had 5 ponds dug on site, wildlife ponds through the Wildlife Trust. So we're hoping that also will have created lots of new habitat that wasn't there when that survey was last done as well.
Yeah, we do have nesting barn owls. We have tawny owls on site too.
That's extraordinary. Okay, are we nearly at the market garden?
Yeah, we're just up here. Right. Here.
Yes, this is a fenced area because we've got lots of deer on site and hares and rabbits, so this is all protected growing space against the things that would work against us.
The wildlife that you want to avoid.
Yeah, so this is just under an acre here. There's a lot going on. We're trying to pack a lot into here.
For people like me who are profoundly ignorant, what's an acre? So is it like a football pitch?
It's a football pitch, right. It's an acre. So it's, just shy of that. And within this fenced-off area, we've got annual growing beds. We've got a small forest garden. We've got... strawberries and other soft fruits. We've got a mixed orchard and a lot of other things going on between all of that as well. But in these beds, they're still fairly low. There's not a lot going on, but you'll see there's a lot of seeds in here. We've already got lettuce.
I can see the lettuce, yeah.
Yeah, some nice mixed varieties of lettuce, radish, parsley, coriander. We've already got our alliums in that we planted last year, so your garlic and your onions. And then you can see some herbs as well. That's some tarragon coming up nicely.
Oh, is it? Right. Where do you sell it then? Where can we buy it?
At the moment, we're working mainly through other food businesses that we're selling to. We're kind of still figuring out how to find a way to get it direct to consumers, but we're also doing monthly work parties where people are coming along and helping in the market garden. So some of those people have been lucky, you know, taking bits and bobs home, and we're hoping to do a bit more of that. But yeah, at the moment, we're predominantly working through local food businesses.
And also, I saw that you grow mushrooms as well.
Yeah, that's right. It's something we've been experimenting with for a good few years now. We started with some home kits that we did inside, and then we kind of tried to work out how we could do this a bit more sort of commercially than doing it outside, using materials that we had to hand. So we've got a lot of trial beds around here using different varieties and different substrates to see what type of mushrooms would grow well in this context.
This must all take a lot of work.
Yep.
Yes, it does. Especially as, you know, we're not using, we don't dig here. We don't use any form of pesticides or herbicides or chemicals. So we'll often start off by sheep mulching an area onto the old pasture. So you'll see an example here. This is a 15 by 15 metre block covered in a sheet. This kills off a lot of the grasses and the weeds.
Yeah.
We'll peel that back, put a mulch on top before we then start planting into it.
What would you use for mulching them?
So we use a lot of different materials. We were quite lucky when we moved onto site that we had a lot of cow manure in one of the barns that had been there for about 10 years. So we used that as the first and the first beds to create fertility. But we also use a lot of wood chip. As well as straw as well from animal bedding.
Yeah.
And so all organic, it's all about adding organic matter to the soil.
Yeah, and I guess that helps with water retention, which at times of dryness
like we've got at the moment.
Yeah, exactly. We're quite...
Because you've got an awful lot of wood chip down here, haven't you?
We do. There's a good sort of 5-10 centimetres along most, around most of the beds here. But what's really surprising is by the end of the season, most of this will have been gone. It'll have rotted down. It will get pulled into the ground by the earthworms.
Yeah.
So an example of what we're kind of growing here, we've got some tea. We got some plants provided to us by a friend, and we're trying to grow our own tea. Yeah.
Tea?
Yeah. So if we get this right, this one sort of 10-metre bed should, we've worked out, provide us about 350 cups of tea when it's at full production.
Well, I've never heard of that before. Right.
Fingers crossed. It'll be a while still.
And what sort of tea is it? Do you know?
I'm not sure well, it's as Camellia sinensis is the tea. Most of the time, it's how you process it. It depends on the tea you get out of it, is my understanding of it.
Oh, well.
It's a hardy variety.
Yeah.
Well, that will cause a great deal of interest, I thought.
Well, that's a lot of...
Willingham tea.
Well, that's a lot of what we're trying to do here, is be really diverse in the things that we grow. You know, we're growing a lot of unusual root vegetables from South America, lots of different types of herbs.
Well, tell me about some of the root vegetables from South America.
Okay, so one thing we grew last year was called mashua, which is a tuber that used to be eaten back in the day. It's also got edible leaves. It's a bit like a nasturtium. We've also grown okra as well, which is like a small lemony potato. When roasted, it's really, really flavourful. So like a lemony potato. We've also grown sweet potatoes that have done really well. So it's just about trying to get more diversity into our diets and also see what grows well in the context and be really resilient against sort of shocks to sort of kind of climate in terms of, you know, years where it's either overly dry or overly wet.
So you've probably got some crops that will withstand drought and some that won't, so you sort of hedge your bets.
Sure, that's it. If you can kind of, if 70% of the crops that you're growing are doing well in any one year, then you're okay. What you don't want to be doing is planting one thing and it be failing.
Absolutely.
And what we're doing at a very small scale, but just to play around a little bit, is, I don't know if you've heard of the population wheat, YQ wheat, we planted out here, which is really about diversity. It's at its core genetic diversity of the wheat. So rather than using just one strain, you've got a local population of a variety of wheat that can then adapt and grow to suit your local local.
So there's lots of experimentation going on here, isn't there, really? But some of these things that you've just mentioned, Steve, some of these South American root vegetables, I'd really like to try some, but if you're not selling them, then...
Well, it's the sort of thing we're aiming to sell in the long term. We're just trying to find our feet with things and not overstretch ourselves at the moment as well.
And also, I'd like some of your tea.
Maybe give us about 3 more years and hopefully we'll be selling some.
Yeah, and this is where the market garden is part of the wider farm system here. We've planted about 2,000 trees since we moved on site a few years ago, because at the moment it's a very open site here. So we're really trying to create...
And are the trees like fruit trees in the main,
at
or
the
is
moment,
it all types of trees?
It's been predominantly UK native species to create things like wildlife habitat, but also windbreak, shelter. We've got north-south agroforestry tree rows throughout the whole site now. So at the moment, it's been a lot of kind of creating the almost getting back to that natural infrastructure of site where that hedgerows back through the whole site. But we've planted a lot of fruit trees, and we're going to, this winter, I think, a big focus on creating more of our food forest orchard varieties as well.
You've got great ambitions. What's this here?
This is a recent planting. This is a sort of linear food forest, and it cuts right through the centre of our market garden. And the aim here is, multiple aims here really, one of which is to create windbreak, so it slows down the wind and stops desiccation during windy and dry times. It also adds shade. You know, it gets really hot, really sunny here. It's good to have some shade at certain times of the day to limit heat stress for some of the more tender crops. But then also this is, there's harvest potential here as well. So we've got apple trees, plum trees, pear trees, then an understory of honeyberries and blueberries.
Honeyberries?
Yeah, so this is a Canadian variety of berry that's similar to a blueberry, but slightly different. And so we're trying that, and that seems to be doing really well. That's its first year it's been
in. It's got a very appealing name, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not quite as sweet, but... Oh, and you'll see there's some bees here.
New bee block.
So we
got,
and this leads us on to another use of this area is to attract pollinators, but also attract predators for pests that we might find on site as well.
So this is a wooden block with holes drilled in it, so that bees can nest or whatever they do in there, lay eggs.
Yeah, volunteers at our last work party made this for us. So yeah, it's a brilliant addition.
Nice to see it's being used by a bee.
Yeah, and underneath there we've got a log pile. So this is to attract things like ground beetles that will predate on slugs and slug eggs. So that should hopefully reduce slug pressure in the long term.
Yeah.
There's a certain element when we're growing the way that we do, the first few years you often get a proliferation of a certain type of pest, but you just kind of need to sort of hold the line a little bit until the predators come. And then when the predators come, things balance out a bit more.
Yeah. Yeah.
You can see an asparagus crop just coming up over here. We've had an amazing first year of harvesting.
Yes, I can see, and just the spears just coming through. And will you eat all of those, or are they going to another destination?
We've eaten a lot.
we've
sold some as well this year, but hopefully a lot more next year.
Yeah, some has gone to some local food trucks. This that you can see here we'll be harvesting in the morning. That's going to an event that's happening tomorrow nearby, and then we'll probably stop harvesting this year and let the ferns and get on with it and get the energy back into the ground.
I know I keep sort of asking this, but I'm sure people would very much like to try produce, so how will they know which food trucks, for example, have got some of your produce?
We post a lot on Instagram about the things that we're doing, so Instagram's probably the first point of call, so that's briar.farm. If people are interested or are a food producer that would like to work with us, they can just give us message us through Instagram or email us at briar.
Well, people like chefs and
like
cafes
chefs, delis, things like that. And then, you know, also if you're just wanting to get involved as well as the work parties, which is a good way of kind of coming and seeing what we're doing and seeing what we're growing.
Yeah, and are they advertised on Instagram as well?
We do that on Instagram as well.
I've not noticed
that. We try and do a monthly work party.
Yeah, brilliant, brilliant. Can I just ask you, is this financially viable? Do you think perhaps now it's very early days, but presumably you think it will be?
I think it's all about the diversification and the aim towards having what we call a stacked enterprise approach. So the market garden by itself, at the scale it is, wouldn't be able to pay for any of this. It's about having a market garden. It's about having our barns being turned into an event space or being open to rent for local businesses.
We've got basketry willow growing as an example. We've got a big long list of hundreds almost of opportunities of different ways of attracting different people onto the site as well as creating different income streams. And I think for us it's very much in the long term it's about creating those multiple income streams and not kind of just relying on growing annual crops.
In all of those multiple income streams, you're staying true to your beliefs, aren't you?
Yeah, that's really important to us with the background in conservation and kind of community development. That's kind of at the heart of everything.
That's fantastic.
Really.
Okay. Well, thanks very much. It's a great place.
Thank you.
Yeah, an impressive place, Briar Farm. And if you want to help out there, check the volunteer dates on their Instagram account, briar.farm. I can't wait to go again and find out how they're getting on. And maybe they'll give me a cup of tea.
Yeah, tea and willow. I'm sure a quick web search will prove me wrong, but I thought tea was a tricky thing to grow. A bit like saffron. You know, like there are pockets of the country, like Saffron Walden is called Saffron Walden because that's where you can grow saffron.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm sure that tea had a similar...
Well, it's growing. I thought of you, Matt, and your love of tea.
Oh, yeah.
I'd almost tried to pinch a couple of leaves for you, but...
I almost would have been there like a shot until they said, well, wait for 3 years, because that's when we'll start.
Well, you ought to go there, Matt, because it's... Go and volunteer there if you're not doing anything.
But... It reminded me so much of the approaches of, say, not so much Co-Farm, but like the Empty Common Community Garden in Brooklands Avenue and so on. You know, taking advantage of diversity in agroforestry and natural windbreaks, blocks, etc. Using the earth to help the earth and keep it going.
You just feel they're doing everything right.
Yeah.
And they're taking their time, they're not rushing it. It's really impressive.
And that was really nice in the way it came across, how they said what they said.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wine, wine, wine. Drink that wine. Okay, on to the wine news now, courtesy of Wine, Wine, Wine by Supercharge. And there are three new wines coming very soon from Gutter and Stars. The 2024 vintages of Bacchus, Sauvignon Blanc and Ortega. On the 3rd of July is the Cambridge Wine Merchants Summer Wine Fair, and there will be more than 100 wines to sample.
There are tastings at Gutter and Stars in French's Road on the 8th of May from 6.30 till 7.30 and the same times on the 22nd of May.
And there are tastings at Grape Britannia in Chesterton Road. That's on the 14th of May and they'll have a tasting of five cocktails at a cost of £30, whilst on the 28th of May there is a tasting of a range of wines made from grapes grown in Essex. And that too is £30. And that rounds up our news for today.
Now, we talk a lot on Flavour about what foods taste good. Asparagus today, for example. But a big area of interest is flavour pairings. What goes with what and why? And I asked our colleague Sue Bailey, who is a food scientist, to tell us about flavour pairings.
Flavour pairings is quite an interesting area. It's probably most well known from coming from Heston Blumenthal with molecular gastronomy a few years back, a number of years back now, in fact, and the idea of combining very weird things together. So, for example, he was trying to look at what would enhance the flavour of white chocolate. And he, first of all, tried smoked duck ham, I think it was some form of cured smoked duck with white chocolate. Then he tried seafood with white chocolate. Not so good. And then he hit upon caviar and white chocolate and found that that actually worked really rather well. And he's come up with some similar exotic pairings ever since.
But how did he think to try caviar? It just seems an extraordinary combination.
Well, he went to see a flavour chemist. And this flavour chemist in Belgium, I believe, he suggested to him, this is the science behind, this is the chemistry behind flavours. And they started to play around with some ideas together. And then this is where this all started from. So, right. Very interesting.
What there are similarities in the chemistry of caviar and white chocolate.
Yes, that they're similar type of compounds that have the same type of, if you like, profile between caviar and chocolate, for example. Another one I read of was kiwi and oysters as a flavour combination. So some really intriguing ones. Vanilla and black pepper was another one as well. So he came up with quite a lot of interesting ones indeed.
To find out if a flavour combination works in practice, you're going to have people tasting them.
You are indeed. So you've got to get your guinea pigs lined up to taste these products. And obviously, if you're a chef, you can potentially do this because you will perhaps have a kitchen. Certainly, if you're Heston Blumenthal, he has a sort of test kitchen that actually works alongside his restaurant anyway. But if you're, say, a chef working in the area, you'll potentially be always playing around with different flavour combinations and ideas. And you may well go and look at probably one of the most interesting books, more for the sort of the normal consumer, the home cook, that's come out recently, a book by Nikki Senyet.
Flavour Thesaurus, yes.
Yeah. It's got some really clever ideas in it, hasn't it?
It has, although I get the impression with most of them that they are things that she has actually tried herself or come across herself in restaurants.
It's a very, very clever book because it makes you think, oh, well, what about that with that? Because obviously we don't all have the services of a nice, tame flavour chemist sitting next to us as we're chopping up and combining things together. But It's a very interesting resource. And there's another resource that I came across fairly recently, which is an online resource. And this is from a guy who had read about the Heston Blumenthal's pairings, thought, well, you know, what about the science behind it? He's actually a scientist by background. And so he has come up with this website, and it is called Food Pairing. Surprise, surprise. And you can actually access it for free, although obviously if you're doing more elaborate things, you have to pay for it. And so what he's done is look at the different flavour profiles of different foods and then work out, OK, what are the volatiles in those flavours and therefore what ones might pair or contrast well together. So it's quite an interesting thing.
Are there any cultural differences?
So yes, so for example, there's some research that was undertaken by one of our own homegrown researchers, who's a theoretical physicist and amateur molecular gastronomist. He's Sebastian Annett of Cambridge University. And what they did was analyse a whole range of recipes, I think more than 50,000 online recipes. And then they looked at them grouped into North American, Latin American, East Asian cuisines. And then they found some quite interesting research there that was comparing the flavour compounds. A lot of it obviously was data-driven. It wasn't actually getting people to taste these things, so it was based from data. But they found that North American cuisine tended to prefer mozzarella, tomato and parmesan, which they all shared a very similar type of particular acid, for methylpentoic acid. And interestingly, he found that East Asian recipes actually very rarely shared any key flavour combinations. So it's this whole area of sort of pairing, contrasting, what does go well, what jars. And so obviously for something like an East Asian cuisine, it's often the contrast of sweet, salt, spicy, which gives you that sort of wow in the mouth. But in fact, what often we call taste is actually smell. So our nasal receptors are actually incredibly sensitive. So this is when you get a cold, you really think, ugh, you know, food is just like eating cardboard and is really unpleasant. So interestingly, if you try and drink coffee with your fingers on your nose, all you'll taste is bitterness. You won't taste any one of the 10,000 different aromatic compounds. Similarly, try an onion with pinching your nose, and it just tastes sweet. You don't get any of that sort of amazing oniony, off-putting raw onion element that you would normally get. When you cook an onion, you know what happens, some of the sweetness comes out. So it's this whole area much more of aroma than anything else that's really important. Perhaps chefs themselves might be what's known as super tasters, because about 25% of the population are super tasters, so they're much more able to distinguish the subtleties of flavour.
How can you tell if you're... Is there an easy test you can tell, take?
Potentially, what happens if you are actually testing people for taste panels, which are often used in the food industry, in fact. I mean, you don't use those, obviously, normally in a chef setting, unless you're getting your friends around to taste dishes or you're getting people in the kitchen to do it. But in the food industry, you will have a lot of taste panels. And in order to screen people, firstly, you have to make sure, obviously, they're not sensitive to certain things. But then you do a check to see what levels of concentration can they taste salt or sweet. And then often that's beginning to pull out perhaps the super tasters, who are slightly more sensitive to, you know, very small gradations in sweetness and in saltiness. And then you then go on to train your panel, and then they become more sophisticated in being able to describe taste, for example, as well as able to differentiate between the different types of taste. Yeah. But that can take 6 weeks or more, and it's an expensive process.
Yes. I can't help but wonder if people who are more sensitive to taste enjoy food more or less than people who are less sensitive.
Good question. I don't know.
And that was Sue Bailey on the subject of flavour pairings. You got something to say about that, Alan?
Well, yes. Sue talks about if you've got a bad cold, how it affects your sense of taste because of the smells that contribute to it. And while I was on holiday, in fact, I developed quite a bad cold and cough. And coffee tasted dreadful. It was extraordinary how dreadful it tasted. And that will be explained by what Sue said. So I thought that was quite interesting.
And there's the music signalling time for news from social media.
Yeah, Coffee World in Milton has monthly specials, and the May monthly specials all sound fantastic. But what about this one, Matt? Fig and pomegranate cake. I've never even experienced that.
I'd go for that, definitely.
Okay, right. And they have other ones as well. I just thought that was particularly interesting. And they're all baked in-house as well. They're open every day from 8 until 4. Some sad news, really. Cotto Restaurant, which used to be in East Road and then moved into the Gonville Hotel and then to the Cambridge Country Club, is closing. It has actually closed because the lease has expired and Hans, the chef, has retired. And his food was just fantastic. I remember you used to go to Cotto in East Road, which they bought from Jack of Gelato fame, actually. But anyway, so it's sad to see that one go. Modigliani in Mill Road will be closed from the 5th to the 9th of May. Then it will reopen again on the 10th of May. Hot Numbers, along with Pixie Brewing, have brewed a coffee pale ale. This is following a blending and tasting session a few weeks ago. Genji coffee from Ethiopia has been used and it brings fruity and sweet flavours with the tropical New Zealand hops in the brew. That really sounds rather good. And it's available throughout the bank holiday weekend.
There's Green Onions taking us into our job section, and we've got three this week, starting with Small Town Bread, who are looking for a head of pastry. Experience working with laminated dough, managing a small team, and attention to detail are essential. The job is based in Sawston. You can apply via the link in the Small Town Bread Instagram bio.
Byron's Bear Pub is recruiting for its front of house team. If you're interested, you can go along on the 8th of May between noon and 4 p.m. to take a look around, meet the team, and drop off your CV.
And finally, Flourish needs a reliable local delivery driver from late May or early June. This is for a Friday mornings delivering from Flourish Farm, which is near Hildesham. And it's an early start too, and you'll need a clean driver's license. So if that interests you, just email office@flourishfarmshop.co.uk for more info. And that takes us to the end of the programme for today. Don't forget we are here on alternate Saturdays at 12 noon and repeated on Mondays at 2 p.m. And we're also available as a podcast from all the usual places. But that's all from us for today. Coming up next on Cambridge Radio is the Music Mix, followed by Home with Daniel Baker.
We'll be back on the 17th of May with lots more food and drink news, jobs and features. But until then, goodbye.
Goodbye.